Sacramento.
Okay, we'll call the Legislative Working Group on Mille Lacs Lake to order. I think this is pretty well known why we're here. The governor has, is this, are we working? Okay. I think the governor has expressed interest in solving an issue on Mille Lacs Lake, at least economically for the area. We're putting this working group together to discuss some of those things before the possibility of maybe a special session. Hopefully we can come together and work out some solutions without having a special session. That's what I would like to see. I hope we move in that direction. And look at all those possibilities. There's the economic issue and there's the fish in the lake. Those are two different directions that we might go. We might do something without a special session. Maybe we need to put together some kind of a package that we can bring in March when the regular session starts for a more long-term solution to these issues. We don't know. That's why we're here today. That's why we have a working group to talk about all those different factors and how we can come together bipartisanly and with the governor's staff and with the administration and the bureaucracy and try to fix this problem, at least solve the immediate economic problems that we're having. So with that, I think we'll get started and we'll just have introductions of the working group and the staff that are at the table, and then we'll start with a presentation from the DNR. So let's start over here. Ms. Chapman, if you want to introduce yourself and who you represent, and we'll go around the table.
Sure. Thank you, Chairman Hackforth. I'm Tina Chapman with Mille Lacs Area Tourism Council.
I'm Karen McCoy, Mille Lacs Area Tourism Council, Isle School Board, and Isle Area Chamber of Commerce.
Good afternoon. I'm John Edmond, Director of Explore Minnesota.
Tom Landwehr, Commissioner of Natural Resources.
John Purcell, State Representative.
Sandra Erickson, State Representative, representing Lake Mille Lacs.
Dale Lewick, State Representative, representing the other half of Mille Lacs.
I'm Danny McNamara, State Representative down in Hastings.
State Representative Tom Hackforth, I represent Northern Anoka County.
Stephanie Lamphere, Committee Administrator.
David Tomasoni, State Senator. I'm the co-chair of the committee, and I want to echo what Representative Hackforth said. And we're not sure there is a good solution here, but and we're not sure that we'll come to an answer today because we may have to have more meetings before we do get to a solution, but we're here today to listen to people and to figure out if there is a good way to go about doing this and whether or not a special session is even merited. So go ahead, Scott.
I'm Scott Sandy. I'm the Committee Administrator for Senator Tomasoni's Environment, Economic Development, and Agriculture Division of Finance.
Senator John Marty from
Rosewood. Rod Skoy, State Senator from District 2, which includes Red Lake, and Red Lake had a walleye collapse in the late 90s, and I worked on that issue as a House member.
Tom Sachs, District 5. The first 10 years that I was in the Senate, I represented the northern half of Mille Lacs Lake, Lake of the Woods, and Rainy Lake, and my new district has Winnie Cutfoot and Leech. Like Red Lake, Leech had a crisis about 5 years ago that we had to deal with.
Carrie Rood, Senate District 10. I have all of Aiken County, all of Crow Wing County. I have the north half of Mille Lacs Lake. I was in represented Senate District 4 when we had the Leech Lake collapse and worked through that very well, I believe, and it's a healthy lake now, and I think we can do that here today, too.
Senator Dave Osmek, Senate District 33, representing Lake Minnetonka area. That seems a little bit out of the area, but I'm actually just here for Senator Brown, who is unable to attend today, so I'm his proxy.
Cynthia Bowerly, Commissioner, Department of Revenue.
Myron France, Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget.
Katie Clark-Sieben, Commissioner of the Department of Employment and Economic Development.
Joan Anquinaby, Commissioner of Corporate Affairs for the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe.
Good. Greg Knapp, Senate Analyst, Senate Council Research and Fiscal Analysis.
Carlin Doyle Fontaine, Senate Counsel.
Dan Mueller, Senate Fiscal Analyst.
Harry Miracle, House Republican Research.
Rachel Buckles, Legislative Assistant.
Janelle Taylor with House Research.
Peter Strohmeyer, House DFL Caucus Research.
Okay, at this time, I think if the DNR is ready to make their presentation, want to come up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Tom Landwehr, Commissioner of Natural Resources, and I've got with me two other staffers.
Okay. Commissioner, if you could hold it 1 second. On the phone, we have Representative Hansen. Is that you?
Yep, I'm on the phone.
Representative Hansen is with us by phone, a member of the working group. Commissioner, please continue. State your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Again, Tom Landwehr, Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. And first off, members, let me express my deep regret that we have to be here today on a beautiful Minnesota day when we really ought to be out fishing. The core reason we're here is biological, and so it's important for us to get a base understanding of the biology of the lake, and that's what Dom Pereira is going to present. With me today is Sarah Strom, an assistant commissioner. Her responsibilities are overseeing the divisions of Fish and Wildlife and the Division of Parks and Trails, and Dom Pereira, who is our fisheries section chief. Sarah will be the face of DNR in many things with respect to this, and Don is really the technical expert on fish management in the lake. And Mr. Chairman, just very briefly before Don gets started, you know, I think the challenges on Mille Lacs have been ongoing for a number of years. We've seen a decline over a period of a few years, and it's often felt like a slow-mo moving accident. But this year, things really came to a head when we exceeded the quota, and we're compelled to close the season down. And so the committee will hear from Don about this biology of the lake, the status of the lake, perhaps what's happened with some of the fish populations, and we can then, Mr. Chairman and others, perhaps talk about some of the options we might pursue in order to get a better a future for the lake.
Okay. And members, let's hold your questions until the presentation is finished, and after that we'll have take questions, and the DNR will be able to answer those, hopefully. So if you do have a question, raise your hand, and we'll keep track of people that are going to want to speak and have a question at the end. Please continue.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to come and present our information to the...
Please
to the
state your name and who you represent for the record.
My name is Don Pereira. I represent the DNR. So my presentation today will cover some background on Mille Lacs. It's important for this working group to understand the myriad of changes that the lake ecosystem has gone through over the past 20 years. And then we'll get into basically the status of the fishery and how things are looking both today, what happened this year to bring us to this unfortunate point, and then some considerations for changes that are going to have to be made in the future as well.
And Chief Pereira, you will have these available for us at a later time?
I'm going to email a copy of that to Stephanie when I get back to the office.
Very good. Anybody that wants one of these... please contact us and we'll provide it.
Okay. So Mille Lacs is a lake ecosystem that has gone through really dramatic changes over the past 30 years. We know that conditions have been warmer. This has favored smallmouth bass that have been expanding pretty rapidly in the lake. We also know that we have seen clear declines in Tulibee Cisco in the lake as well. They're fairly abundant right now, but as you'll see later in my presentation, there was a time where we thought we were possibly going to see them extirpated from the lake. That's a very, very highly valued food item for predator fish. We know that the water of the lake has cleared up over time. We know that plant beds, aquatic plants, are growing deeper and they're more abundant. We know that we've had increased production of northern pike. Northern pike, as you know, is an ambush predator. It likes plants. So if you increase plants, you're going to increase northern pike habitat. Unfortunately, we've had several invasive species successfully establish themselves in Mille Lacs. The most notable one is zebra mussels. The only positive note right now in zebra mussels is that their numbers have stabilized. They've even come down a little bit in the past several years. So we don't know really what the full impacts of zebra mussels are. The nastier one is this creature right here, spiny water flea. We have it in several waters in the state, including the border waters, Rainy, Lake of the Woods. We know that this is a predator on small zooplankton. These are the same food items that very young fish need to survive. And we know that spiny water flea predation has greatly changed the zooplankton community in Mille Lacs. So these are all system changes that are actually affecting the fishery, and we're trying to figure it out. So this is my next slide shows this change in water clarity that started quite some time ago. This simply could be the initial benefit of the Clean Water Act, decreasing nutrients to the lake. If you decrease nutrients to the lake, you're going to decrease productivity. Water clarity is going to increase. Some people think this might be due to zebra mussels, but we know this happened well before zebra mussels. This big peak in 2013 was related to very early ice out. We typically see clear water when we have early ice out. In fact, we saw clear water all around the state that year. So this increased water clarity is a really big thing. It's going to decrease potential. If it's nutrients, it's going to decrease the whole productivity of the system. It's also going to change behavior. It's going to allow plants to grow deeper. We also know that we did see a shift in younger year walleye. We know that we know now, unfortunately, and this is the crux of the problem. Younger year walleyes have lower survival now than they did 20 years ago. And we're fairly certain that these young walleyes are now starting to move off into deeper water at a smaller size. We used to seine for them in the summer on the beaches in July. Some of those seine catches in the 90s went to zero because we feel those fish were moving off into deeper water at a smaller size. If they're moving in the deeper water, it's likely that they're going to be exposed to a higher predation rate. And so here's catches of younger year walleye in our assessment nets. You can see that prior to the late 90s, we would catch some in some years, and after that, we started catching them much more consistently in our gill nets. So those are gill nets that are set in September in deeper water. These fish are typically 4 to 6 inches at that time. Any predator that's 14 inches or larger is going to be able to prey on them quite easily. So that's a key hypothesis. When we had this analysis, we had the entire Mille Lacs analysis reviewed by that Blue Ribbon panel. They came to the same fundamental conclusion. Young walleyes are not surviving well after their first summer, and they're not surviving to replenish the fishery and also replenish the spawning stock as well. That is our key challenge. So here's northern pike. We can see clearly that northern pike are up in abundance. We now do a focused northern pike assessment in September. We know that from that assessment, in two recent years, we had record levels of juvenile pike production. Pike are doing very well in Mille Lacs, and we're trying to encourage people to use them as well. And here's smallmouth bass, increasing quite dramatically over time. They're still not a dominant predator, but they're increasing. They're clearly increasing in abundance. We're managing primarily for trophy fishery, but they're a fine eating fish too, and we feel that we can possibly maintain the trophy fishery with the one over 18 inches, but allow and even encourage harvest of fish smaller than 18 inches. So we're seeing how that works. But they've probably benefited from longer growing seasons. We clearly see impacts on smallmouth bass young survival in northeast Minnesota, where we have really short growing seasons. We see that in our other lakes as well. So they're probably benefiting from longer growing seasons. So we did a detailed analysis of what the predators in the lake have been consuming. This study was done in 2012 and 2013 and then repeated the following year. Even though walleyes are down in abundance, they're still the dominant predator in the lake. There's still probably four or five walleyes to every northern pike. And you can see that in 2012, 2013, this is the consumption rate of juvenile walleyes by these three predators. The dominant predator on juvenile walleyes was other walleyes. Pike were a small component. Smallmouth bass weren't even measurable. The following year, walleyes are coming down in abundance. The impact of walleyes on juvenile walleye was lower. And that year, northern pike actually ate more juvenile walleyes in the lake than the walleyes did themselves. So, and then smallmouth bass, they pick up a few juvenile walleyes in the fall, but we really don't think they're a dominant predator on juvenile walleyes. What we feel is that the bottom line is that because of this change in young walleye behavior, increased water clarity, essentially every predator in the lake is able to prey more efficiently on small walleye. And therein lies the primary challenge in trying to managing this lake for the future. So the other thing I want to talk about is fish size and how that affects consumption rates. So this top graph simply shows that the specific consumption rate of a fish slows down as they get larger. So fish basically grow throughout their lives, but their rate of growth really slows down as they get larger. And there's fundamental laws to explain this. All of this has been documented extremely well in the laboratory and in the field by fish biologists doing really good work over many, many years. So we wanted to look at what the overall predatory impact if you manage a walleye population in two different ways. So we used the approximate total poundage of walleyes that we would see in Mille Lacs when it was healthy, and we looked at total consumption of a walleye population that was younger fish. So we weren't protecting older fish. maybe the statewide, you know, six-bag limit, no size restrictions. You wouldn't see a lot of fish larger than 20, 22 inches in that population. A bulk of the population would probably be running between 14 and, say, 18 inches. And so that's this estimate in this first green bar. Total predation, this is actually pretty amazing. Total consumption by this youngest population would be 8,000 tons of forage in 1 year to support that population. That number in and of itself speaks to how incredibly productive these large lake walleye fisheries are and how much energy is processed through the food web to support this predator. But if you compare this to an older population, say we change our management and we put in a protected slot, we want to protect fish so we have a larger number of larger fish, but the same biomass. Total predation by that population actually goes down because this effect of larger fish consuming at a lower rate. The simple way I like to describe it to people is that if you looked at the pile of fish that a 10-pound walleye would eat in 1 year, it would be a lot less than 5 2-pound walleye and a lot less than 10 1-pound walleye. So the counterintuitive thing here is that a big fish is an eating machine. That's not really correct. And it's the same thing we go through with trying to manage northern pike and muskellunge as well. So that's a very important aspect of the Mille Lacs system that we're learning through this very, very detailed analysis of the diets of predators and the estimate of their total consumption rate. So we do have key uncertainties in the system, and that's what is going on with production of our primary forage species, namely yellow perch and Tulipi cisco. We think perch may be down. We're not certain. We know that Tulipi cisco are looking really grim for a while. There are a lot of them in the lake right now, and that's great, and I think that's what's driving the healthy fish that we're seeing, because the fish have good condition this year, so that's a really good thing. But there's still a lot of uncertainty. We expect to see impacts of these invasive species on the production of key forage species, but we don't know how that's going to happen or when. So it's a very difficult and complex problem that's going to require a lot of intensive work to really try to ferret it out. So here's a look at Tulipi cisco. This graph on the left is statewide trend. You can see clearly that they're trending down throughout the state. Some of our forecasts 50 years out, we have cisco in about 640 lakes in the state. If the climate trend continues, we're probably going to lose them in over half. They won't be able to persist because of warmer conditions. And then in Mille Lacs, we can see what happened to Tulipi cisco in Mille Lacs based on our assessment nets. In 2006, we caught so few, we thought they were on the way out. But given the right conditions, they can produce a lot of fish in a hurry. And fortunately, that's what they did in the following years. And today we have a fair amount of, I think, 1 and 2-year-old cisco, Tulipi cisco in the population, which is great, because it's going to feed these predators, so we need them. We hope they can persist. 2013, everybody knows that was a big year class of walleye. We had a lot of 1-year-old and 2-year-old yellow perch in the lake during that time. That's a really good thing, because higher forage abundance will buffer the predation on smaller walleyes. If you get into a year like 2001, where forage is really, really low, or 2002 rather, predation on those young walleyes was so severe, the 2000 and 2001 year classes of walleye were exterminated by predation because the walleyes didn't have other food to eat. They didn't have that buffer. So these dynamics between the abundance of the forage fish and the predator walleye and the other predators in the system is critically important to try to figure out, but it's not easy. So I want to talk about, there's been a lot of talk about our creel surveys. How do we estimate what the anglers catch? First of all, creel survey methodology has been developed intensively in the general fisheries world by some very smart statistical type people over many, many years. So we know how to do this. The Mille Lacs creel is one of the best in the state. It's been extensively reviewed over the past 20 years. We've done it consistently. Statistically, it has relatively high precision. These typically are surveys that are hard to do with much precision, but we're running at about 15% precision on Mille Lacs, which is about as good as you can expect with a sport angler survey. We use a type of statistical design called non-uniform probability on Mille Lacs. The same design is used on some of our other large lakes, and it statistically it performs very well. There's three basic components to an angler survey. We have to interview the anglers to get their catch rates. We have to count landings at specific stations around the the lake and then expand that into total fishing effort, the total number of hours fishing. The amount of fishing effort times the catch rate gives us what the total catch is. But then because of special regulations, we know that anglers also have to release fish. So we have to ask the anglers, how many fish did you release and what size were they? And the reason why we need to know those release rates is because the other component, unfortunately, of the way we're fishing these days is hooking mortality. It's very controversial, but it's an important part of a sport fishery managed this way. And we use slot limits, and it's an important tool all around the state. So let's talk a little bit about hooking mortality. That's the amount of fish that die after an angler releases them back to the water. We did our own, there's been hooking mortality studies. We did the first one in Minnesota back in the mid-80s. We've done other ones around the state. There have been hooking mortality studies done on a number of species and on walleye and other states. We did our own intensive study on Mille Lacs in 2003-2004. This study was done, it was a good solid design, it was done really well, and we sent it in for peer scientific review, which is anonymous review by random scientists around the country, and it was published in a well-established fishery journal. So it's a well-done study. We found out that the two primary factors that influence whether a walleye will die or not after it's released are temperature, a very strong factor is temperature, and also size of fish. Smaller walleyes and larger walleyes die at a greater rate than intermediate-sized walleyes. We also, when we did this study, we measured the temperature. We had big pens that went from the surface all the way down to the bottom in 20 feet of water. The walleyes were caught normally by normal anglers. We told them to do nothing different. We put them in the pens for 5 days. If they're going to die from hooking mortality, they're going to die within 5 days. And we recorded the mortality. And we measured other information. We measured water temperature at the net pen. So these were offshore temperatures. When we run our hooking mortality model now, our creel clerks measure those temperatures inshore. And it can be a little bit warmer inshore than offshore. So we recalibrated the hooking mortality model back then for inshore temperatures, the way that our creel clerks are actually measuring that water temperature. So there's essentially, and that when we looked at that relationship again, it's pretty tight. There's nothing goofy going on there. So we're pretty confident that we're capturing the temperature effect fairly well. And so this year, the first half of July, was very warm. So this red line is how the water temperatures are looking in the lake this year. For comparison, we see 2012. 2012 was another warm year where we had high hooking mortality. The black line is the average over a period of 25 years. So this year is...
No flat line on it.
Black line. The black line, sorry. The black line is average hooking mortality over 25 years. It's warm this year. The other thing that affects the water temperature is dew points, specifically at night. Because the way a lake loses heat at night after the sun goes down is evaporative cooling at the surface. We worked with the engineers at the University of Minnesota to figure some of this stuff out. You have high dew points at night, that rate of evaporative cooling is a lot lower, and the lake doesn't lose as much heat. And you know we've had pretty steamy weather as well. So it's a warm year, and that's driving hooking mortality up. And here's a graphic that's showing you how dramatic this effect of temperature is on hooking mortality, also size of fish as well. So when we climb up above 70 degrees for water temperature, it starts to really go up. Not a good thing. High hooking mortality. High hooking mortality is not a good thing. We don't like it. It's a waste of fish. This also shows length, too. I think it was last week at one of our stations, we measured temperatures that were almost 78 degrees. Down on Lake Pepin in some years, we'll have surface temperatures in the 90s. So it's a difficult situation. Walleye are a cool water fish, as are northern pike. They don't do good in warm conditions, especially if you stress them. So we feel like we have a good way of estimating hooking mortality. We're fairly pretty confident. So what happened this year? So basically, and I'll show you later in the presentation, the decline of walleyes. But together with the bands, we determined that we need to really slow down this decline in spawning fish in the lake. We don't want to get to a red lake. We don't want to get to that point. So we determined that we can only kill enough fish to allow some fishing, but to not exacerbate this decline in spawning fish. So we had a really small safe harvest level of only 40,000 pounds. The state's allocation was 28,600 pounds. So we had razor-thin margins for trying to manage this fishery and keeping it open, and not even going, for example, to catch and release. So we worked with our input group to come up with the regulations we have this year that would hopefully give us maybe an 80% chance of not having to go to catch and release or closure. And we were looking really good through June. Through June, we had a harvest of a little over 13,000 pounds from all sources. And then the first half of July came, and things changed dramatically. Fishing effort increased 30% for the first 2 weeks in July. That was likely driven by very nice conditions during the holiday weekend. And if some of you have been following this, we've done an awful lot to try to ease restrictions to allow people to at least be out on the water, even if they can't be fishing for walleye. So we might have actually increased the amount of fishing pressure during the day for walleye as well, perhaps. I talked about water temperatures rising really dramatically. The really crazy thing that happened, this is why this is the perfect storm. For only the second time in 30 years, catch rates in the fishery went up the first half of July compared to the open water fishery from the opener through June. That's only happened one other time in the 30-year history we've been running the creel. Catch rates of all fish, big and small, approximately doubled. Hooking mortality went through the roof. We suddenly were at a situation where we're killing over 800 pounds of walleyes per day. We screamed past our allocation. We lost any opportunity for going to a catch-and-release fishery. It was grim. It was very grim. That's why we're here today. The latest report shows that effort is back down. It looks like catch rates of larger fish might have come down, but catch rates of these smaller fish are actually going up. So even when we close the fishery, there's going to be incidental catch of walleye because we still want people to go up and fish for the other species. So we're still going to be accumulating a little bit more kill of walleyes. Hopefully it'll be minimal. We want people to go up and fish, but we really want them to try to avoid fishing for walleyes if at all they can. So now I want to talk about how we managed this lake in the past and the changes that we're going to have to make in the future. We had a basic harvest control rule. What we did is we each year in January we would take all of our data and we would estimate the total poundage of fish larger than 14 inches and we would allow a total kill of 24% of all those divided between the band's fishers and the state anglers. We now know that from outside review, we now know that 24% is likely too high. If we get this walleye fishery back on its feet, we'll probably change that going forward. So we're going to have a new control rule for the fishery in the future. We don't know exactly what that would be like. We also know that both fisheries, the state's fishery and the tribal fishery, are very size selective. Both fisheries put a lot of fishing pressure on walleyes between 15 and 18 inches. Because of the size selective nature of sport fishing and also behavior of walleyes when they're spawning. We now know that for a sustainable fishery, you want to take that exploitation rate and you want to spread it across many sizes and ages as possible. So that's another fundamental change we need to make in the future if and when we get this walleye population back on its feet. We also know that males, for example, are vulnerable to harvest longer. They grow slower, so they don't reach our protective slot. And we know that they linger longer in the spawning grounds, too, at night when they're spawning. So we see a higher ratio of males in the tribal harvest as well. But it's kind of remarkable that both fisheries kind of operate in the same way. So now to take a look at the changes. We focused too much fishing pressure on fish smaller than 18 inches. And you can see this is when tribal fishing started. This is when the state started using the slot limits. And here's a rapid decline in the abundance of those intermediate-sized fish between 14 and 20 inches, both males and females. The good news is that we actually conserved a lot of big fish. And you can see that in this graphic here, especially for females. When they hit the protected slot, we had them in the lake for quite a while. But now we have a declining female population as well. That female population, first of all, walleyes die of natural causes, probably at a rate of 15 to 20% per year. Remember, we don't have young fish surviving. We don't have young fish coming up to replenish the spawners that we know are declining just from natural causes, even if we're not fishing them that much. So this is the big concern right now. This is why we're at a 30-year low in spawner abundance in the lake. So when we manage fishing mortality, that's the fundamental thing that a fishery manager has to do, is manage fishing mortality. There's two components of fishing mortality. There's the total amount of fishing, how many angler hours are out there, and also the catchability of the fish. The product of those two tells us what fishing mortality is. We have open access fisheries in Minnesota. We don't tell people that they can't go fish somewhere. They just go fish where they want to. For example, when we manage the deer herd, and some years when the herd is small, we can't let everybody kill antlerless deer. There's a lottery. I'll have a lottery in my zone this year on whether I get a doe tag or not. If we wanted to limit fishing effort on Mille Lacs, we could have a lottery, and if you get lucky and you draw a fishing tag, you can go fishing on Mille Lacs during a certain time period. But my hunch is that the public doesn't want that, and that could be a major impact on the local economy as well. So they're open access fisheries. That leaves us with this catchability part to try to work with. And the way we try to sculpt that is with these size and bag limits. That's our fundamental tool of trying to manage total fishing mortality. And it's challenging, as you can now see. So a little bit more about Mille Lacs to show you how intense this lake is, close to the Twin Cities. This is Mille Lacs fishing effort over quite a period of time. We can see that even with restrictive regulations, it's still relatively high. Each of these colored bars is the average fishing effort in different large lakes. So Vermilion has about 15 angler hours per acre. Rainy's really quite low, but you can see how intensely Mille Lacs is fished. It's an intensive fishery. Here's total angler kill in Mille Lacs over the years. So you can see it's coming way, way down now. This event in 1992, anglers killed 1.2 million walleyes in Mille Lacs in 1 year. That's at the time when Mille Lacs was fully productive. That's probably three times the rate of average production for walleyes in that lake. Back before water cleared up, we figured Mille Lacs would probably on average support a harvest of about 400,000 to 500,000 pounds of walleyes. In an unregulated fishery like this, an open access fishery with no size restrictions, anglers killed 1.2 million pounds in 1 year. It was crazy. And here we are today with very, very low harvests. You can see how low the harvests are in pounds per acre in the other large lakes. Mille Lacs in its heyday was a walleye factory. It set the stage for very high expectations, and it allowed the capitalization of a very intensive sport fishery, fueled by lots of anglers coming out of the Twin Cities that could get there quickly. Now here's some trends where we're at today with spawning fish, both males and females. This is where we're very concerned. The red line is our gill net index. The blue line is the very sophisticated catch-at-age model that we run that's been reviewed by outside experts. You can see that fortunately, there's differences from year to year, but fortunately they show the same trend, and that's what you would hope to see. So males have been declining for quite a while. In more recent years, females have started to come down as well. That's not good news. We need to conserve these spawners somehow. But here is the good news. Mille Lacs is a walleye factory. It's got an incredible amount of spawning habitat. Along the east, west, and south shores, it's like one big massive spawning shoal. And it's onshore, so it's scoured by the ice in the spring, which means zebra mussels won't colonize it. And there's still, if you give walleyes good habitat, and you have enough spawners, they will produce fish. And this is what's going on with age zero walleyes indexed by electrofishing late in the summer. They're still cranking out a lot of young fish. Age zero fish are very abundant in the summer electrofishing surveys, and that's a good thing. So the system is not spawner limited now. We don't know when it will become spawner limited, but we need to watch it carefully. And if it does become spawner limited, then we're going to have to figure out how we can do what we did on Red Lake, and that's possibly stock fry into the system. But let's compare this lake with Red Lake, because we hear, well, what about Red Lake? You stock fish there. The red line is Red Lake for pounds per acre of female spawning biomass. You can see it was rock bottom. Here's Mille Lacs. Lots of female spawners. Still today, there's lots of female spawners, but they're coming down. This huge meteoric rise in Red Lake was because we successfully stocked walleye fry in there to the tune of 33 to 40 million in 99, 2001, and 2003. We had to close the Red Lake walleye fishery for 7 years. I hope that Mille Lacs is only closed for a month and a half. I hope the heck it's not closed for 7 years. But we know how to stock fry, and if this system does get spawner limited, we'll figure out how to do it. But we also know that the Mille Lacs walleye population is the most genetically unique in the state, so we need to take those eggs from Mille Lacs. So we're working with tribal partners to figure out, to develop a plan for how we would do that if and when we get to that point. I'm fairly confident that we can do it. So here's, quickly, I'm almost done. This is total kill over the course of both fisheries. The blue line is the state kill coming down over time for a variety of reasons. And then the green line is a total tribal kill from the onset of their fishery to our present day. And so finally, to summarize, again, we really need to, we want to try to allow some fishing, but we really need to maintain these walleye spawners. The 2013 year class is looking fantastic, but we won't really know for sure until we see how they show up in our September assessment nets. We know when they were caught as yearlings in our assessment nets last year, they were even higher than the massive 1988 year class. And they're growing well. They're 10 to 13 inches. They're plump. We really hope they show up. We hope they're surviving. So the 2015 regulation, again, was a very conservative one. We wanted to allow some harvest, but we had to stay. We could not go over our allocation. So we need conservative management until we hopefully see this trend turn around and we see young walleye surviving better to replace those current spawners. So it's important to realize that the 2013s are great. We hope there's more young fish coming up behind them, but we can't fish them too hard because we need them to replenish the spawning population in the lake. So that concludes my presentation, and I will be happy to try to answer any questions you might have.
Okay, thank you, Chief. And just a little housekeeping to start with. We will try to allow some time for public testimony towards the end of the hearing today. This hearing will conclude at 5 p.m. We'll be meeting from 3 until 5. We'll be finished at 5. We have a number of things to discuss, so we'll be all done at 5 o'clock. We will now take questions from the members for the DNR, but if people want to, if we have time for public testimony, please see Emily. Emily, raise your hand. Please see Emily and put your name on the list if you would like to provide some testimony towards the end of the hearing today. So with that, members that have questions, Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your presentation, Mr. Pira. I'm looking at your harvest statistics from 81 to 2000, and I'm noting that, and you already mentioned the 92 fantastic, over a million pounds harvested, but I'm looking at 99 and comparing it to 2000. How do you account for a harvest of 611,000 in 99 and then one of the lowest at 224,000 in 2000? Doesn't this sort of show us that Lake Mille Lacs is a lake that has ups and downs, mm-hmm. and somewhat dramatic? So how do you account for that? I have some other statistics, too, that are pretty dramatic. But
yeah, it's definitely, even prior to tribal fishing, it was definitely a fishery that was highly variable from year to year. You know, you would hear it called these dead sea years, and we had years with really, really low total harvest, just with regular statewide regulation. But those years when catch rates were super low was when the forage were really, really abundant. I mean, we would do trawls for young year yellow perch, and we would be filling up 55-gallon drums with the number of young year yellow perch we're catching in our trawls. That was back before all these invaders were in the lake, before we had clear water. The lake was incredibly productive. It was a factory. Now, what happened early on and when the tribe started fishing, we weren't sure how to regulate our harvest. They gave us leeway to try to figure it out. We tried to work with minimums the first couple of years. And those first few years, we shot way over our allocation. The tribal harvests were really low. The declarations were really low. So they gave us some time to try to figure it out, and that's when we moved into the period where we had using slot limits. Now, what would happen in some years, we would have a five-year management window, and the state had something called an overage plan. So we were allowed to go over in our allocation in certain years. But within that five-year window, we had to balance it to a net zero fish for the state's fishery relative to what its total summed allocation would be over those 5 years. So what was happening for us to do that, we had pretty dramatic regulation changes from year to year. And we were told by the locals that that was kind of bad for business. So they informed us, and they said, we would prefer to have more conservative harvests and leave more fish in the lake than have to have regulation changes from year to year. And all that was taking place at about the same time that some of these changes in the lake ecosystem were going on as well. We're trying to figure that out before we even realized, before we even had the data to show that we weren't getting young fish surviving yet. So that was the early, you know, the early kind of ups and downs we went through in trying to figure out how to manage the system.
Mr. Chair, just a follow-up.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So to what extent, because I cited 99 and 2000, did the DNR pay attention to your former employee Dick Sternberg's report of 2 and then his follow-up in 3? And last year he wrote an opinion piece, I believe it was in the Star Tribune, also reminding you that there were some things that needed to change.
Sure.
To what extent did you pay attention to his study, since he was a biologist of yours?
Mr. Sternberg was concerned about the buildup of large fish, and that's why we did that really detailed predation analysis to show that if you take the same biomass of an intermediate-sized fish, the same poundage, and change it to the same poundage of larger fish, you don't create an eating machine. That's a fundamental misunderstanding. I realize it's very counterintuitive for the public, but that basic biological result is pretty robust. Now the problem, this is the hooking mortality problem. If we have a year with really high catch rate like 2002, a lot of those big fish are still getting caught and they're getting released and they're dying. And that's bad. We realize that that's bad. But at the time, you know, our hands were tied in trying to figure out how to manage this thing to allow for as much fishing as possible and not limit access to the lake.
Representative Erickson?
No, that's for now. That'll be good.
Representative Louie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Director Barrera. Look through there. I'd like to explore the concept of hatchery and stocking a little more, and I guess... One, can you speak a little bit more specific about the genetic issue? I guess second, it just strikes me that we got nowhere to go if we're going to play the can only stock Mille Lacs walleyes and Mille Lacs Lake. So what should we be thinking about in the future, and who should be doing that?
Okay. I did not have a slide of the genetics results, but if I did, they're very, very compelling. Mille Lacs is very, very unique. I know we stocked it in the past. When you look at how productive this lake is or how productive it was, the numbers that we put in the lake were almost silly. So we didn't put enough genetically different fish in there to make a hill of beans difference on impacting the local genome that was already in the lake. That's in stark contrast to Red Lake. And even on Red Lake, it was very painful to the technical committee, because I was on that committee, to decide to bring in an outside source. We went with Pike River fish, because our analysis showed that genetically they were closer to Red Lake fish than actual other spawning runs like the Lake Sally run from the Red River drainage was. So we've essentially swamped the genome in Red Lake, and it's likely that the Red Lake genome of walleye is now gone. It's now replaced with the Pike River fish, or some hybrid between Pike River and the native Red Lake walleye fish. There's an immense amount of information in the fisheries literature about how bad outbreeding depression can be. We know what inbreeding depression is. That's when two organisms that are really closely related reproduce and they have low fitness. There's also outbreeding depression as well. It's very well documented in fish populations right now. The best experiment that was done was with largemouth bass from Florida. They were crossed with largemouth bass from northern states. Their young were more susceptible to largemouth bass virus because of outbreeding depression. So we have very good cause and very good reason to really want to conserve that Mille Lacs genome the way it is. We did answer your query about where else we stock. There are a couple lakes upstream of Borden Lake where some fish from, they're probably Pine River fish, are stocked. But our tagging studies show that there's probably very few of those fish that actually make it down to Mille Lacs. So Mille Lacs is a pretty, it's the closest thing to a genetically pure population of walleye that we have. But we're fairly confident that we can get in and get those eggs. We can take hatch rates in the wild that are maybe 10% in a good year, and we can increase them fivefold in the hatchery. And we know that we can net a lot of spawning walleyes in Mille Lacs because we've done it when we've gone in to do tagging studies in the spring. So we don't think getting the eggs out of Mille Lacs for stocking in the future, if we get to that point, is going to be problematic. We're pretty confident we can do that. I hope that answers your question.
Mr. Chairman, a member, if I could add one thing to that, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Commissioner.
So as we are preparing for what we're going to do next, and as part of the package you're going to be looking at, we believe, as Don suggested, that we can currently capture reproducing adults in Mille Lacs, strip the eggs, strip the milk, and put them into a state hatchery. Since this is an infested water, there are grave concerns about biosecurity. We don't want to spread spiny water flea, for instance, so we would have to do some very special things. But part of one of the packages that we're talking about, one of the proposals in the package you're looking at, would call for a Mille Lacs specific research station and hatchery so that we could, if we need to, do that right there on the lake. And I think to take off a little bit on what Don said, Red Lake was in a very unique situation. It was spawner limited. There weren't enough spawners in there to produce eggs. Mille Lacs is not there yet. But we don't want to wait until it's there and then act too late. I think Don was telling me earlier in the day that one of the challenges we had with Red Lake is we found out, by the time we acted on the fact that it was spawner limited, we had lost several years. And so we could have gone in earlier and started stocking had we known that we could be doing that. And so we want to be prepared at Mille Lacs if we should get to that point. We're hoping we don't, but if we should get to that point, we want to be prepared at Mille Lacs to be able to stock as needed.
Chief Pereira and I were talking about this just a few weeks ago before the governor got on board with maybe doing a special session or anything. We had a conversation about this very issue, about possibly doing that very thing. Chief Pereira, did I hear you say that Mille Lacs had been stocked with walleye at one time? I thought I was told that there hadn't been any walleye stocking done to the lake.
No, we stock walleyes everywhere in this state back. And, before there was fish management, there was fish being hatched and stocked everywhere. I mean, we did such crazy things. We even put salmon like in Minnetonka or whatever before we knew anything about fish biology. We didn't really start to understand conservation genetics as it relates to fish until the 1980s. We didn't have our statewide genetic plan for walleyes even in place until the 90s. So there were fish going into Mille Lacs in the 70s. Back then, we were so naive that we were even ecologically naive. We thought we could take a factory like that, and if we put a few more fish in, we'd have better fishing, and it was silly, and it was naive, and it was wrong. So the amount of fish that we put in were basically trivial. And, for example, what we know, what we discovered, like in Moose Lake, muskie genetics was just amazing. Because we insulted that Moose Lake population with shoepack fish, with Wisconsin muskies, and then when we left it alone, our genetic analysis showed that the native genome that was there came back because they were locally adapted, and they drove that other genetic material right out of the population. So we know there's local adaptation of our native fish, and we know that they're the best things for that specific lake where they became locally adapted.
Mr. Lewick, anything further?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a general comment that, we don't want to get to the point where you've got no choice, but it would seem like we need to look at an investment here and an insurance policy that we don't have to be sitting here trying to figure out the details, that we're already able to turn that on instantly. And as long as we can get any excess that would be produced at that effort into other lakes without taking spiny water fleas with, we can, use that those fish for other things. If we, we'd be nice that we'd never need them in Mille Lacs, but we really need to be looking and hedge our bets here long term. And that may be one way to do it. But thank you,
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up to your question, Mr. Chair, Chief, do you have the ability to actually strip fish next spring and actually raise them on the shores of the lake? Is that feasible even for next year?
Well, we wouldn't raise them on the shores of the lake, but we would find a cool water hatchery that has the necessary biosecurity systems in place, and we would raise them there. I haven't had a chance to check with our cool water production coordinator yet. My hunch is that the Brainerd Hatchery has that biosecurity system in place, because the Pine River fish are running out of Gull Lake, and Gull Lake is a zebra mussel infested. But I need to check with our folks first to determine. I'm fairly confident that we can probably find the hatchery, the safe hatchery space, to do it this coming spring. Right now, we're quite certain that our fry production is very high, so I don't think we would be benefiting the current population to do that. But the point is that we could move very quickly to do it with our current infrastructure. And then if we had to do it long-term for the lake because of these ecological problems that we can't figure out, then the best thing would be to have a facility right there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chief, yes, the Pine River facility is now zebra mussel, but it's on whitefish chain. Unfortunately, it's just a mile from our place. And, yes, so I was curious. So you think you can do the biosecurity and potentially Brainerd and would be able to do that if restocking was a plan? And when it was done in the 70s, do we know even if they used Mille Lacs fish when they did it in the 70s?
I really doubt that they did, because we had the easiest way to collect eggs is to put a trap in a river run. So, for example, Pike River up in Vermilion and Cutfoot Sioux are our two biggest hatchery operations for walleye, and those are large river traps. It's more intensive labor-wise because we would have to use trap nets in the lake, but we know we can do it. Our Coronas run over by Painesville, those fish are trapped in the lake, and we run a spawning operation over there. We're confident we can do this. We just have to get the staff out there to do it, and then we just have to find the hatchery space. I don't know where that hatchery space would be now, but I'm quite confident that we can find it if we needed to.
Senator Squay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions. First, dealing with hooking mortality, if hooking mortality is such an important issue with regard to the fish killing, why not just limit the number of fish that people catch to two and forget the size stuff and the throwing back and just let them take two fish and that's it?
We've run all sorts of scenarios, and when we've run scenarios like that, in Mille Lacs in some years, we'd run way over our quota in a hurry, our allocation. We've considered that. Other options would be to just close it to walleye fishing during the warm months and have people fish for something else. That would save a lot of hooking mortality, and then we'd have a better fishery. You know, if you look at our large lake walleye fisheries, a bulk of the harvest happens in May and June anyway. So, but still, that would be a stressful thing for the local businesses to deal with if we had to close walleye fishery during the warm months of July, the warm weeks of July.
Senator Spy.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And then to the point of closing the lake, this last winter, Red Lake had a limit change during the middle of the season. The technical group worked with the DNR. And one of the issues that they brought up is that maybe a little more flexibility for the DNR to respond faster when they see these issues arising. I heard in your testimony today that you race through the allowable harvest. It seems to me that perhaps, Commissioner, this should be directed to you. You could make, we could go back and revisit some of the conversations that we had earlier this year about legislative changes that the department would need to allow you to respond faster when you see these issues arising, so we don't get to this point on these special managed lakes. It seems to me that we should figure out mechanisms to put in place so you identify these issues sooner, make the changes to the limit or the slot or whatever you figure is appropriate, so that we don't end up closing lakes, because that's really when the economic negatives occur. If they can still come and fish, even if it's only one or two or a reduced amount, it's much better than having these closures, and I'd like the DNR to go revisit that conversation. I think I had this with you in January or February or whenever it was of this last year. We should revisit that and see what the legislature needs to act upon.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, members, and that's a really good point, Senator. I think, you know, in this particular case, because the allocation was so low, it was just very easy to get up to that level and exceed it. But one of the challenges we had, and I did get a letter from Representative Lewick and Representative Hackbarth and Representative Erickson, and I apologize, I didn't respond to that directly because we'd already blown past the opportunity to do catch and release. But one of our calendar challenges, frankly, was we have to put a notice in the state register. Well, if that goes in on Monday, it doesn't get published until the next Monday. So we had a one-week delay. Even though we could see this coming, there was no way we could get a register notice out quick enough to allow us to perhaps go to catch and release. And so there are some things we could consider changing with respect to our CREEL survey. That's done every 2 weeks. If we anticipate we might hit that, perhaps we can shorten that up to 1 week so we know where we're headed. But that state register notice adds a week to our ability to respond.
Senator Squay.
I think both policy chairs are here, and I would hope that you'd be working with them to make those changes this coming session.
Senator Root.
Thank you. I noticed in all the very many variables in the biology of the lake, you mentioned the lake being warmer, more aquatic plants, the zebras, the spinies, the clarity. I mean, there's so many things that go into the decisions in this lake. One of the things when we were dealing with Leech Lake was the cormorants, and that was one of the biggest issues on that lake. In my own lake, on Pelican Lake, that's a big issue right now. We have a huge flock on Pelican Lake that's kind of decimating the walleyes. When we were at the meeting last Friday in Isle, there were several residents that brought up the cormorants on Spirit Island and that there was a big flock out there. And as I was wondering if maybe you could address that also in part of the lake management.
Chief Pereira.
Sure. So the Spirit Island cormorant colony is managed as part of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service National Refuge System. It's actually managed as part of the Rice Lake National Refuge. So you have that federal program to try to deal with. And for them to allow direct control of a native species, you need to show clearly that native species is negatively impacting another native species. So what we did is we brought our experts in that worked on Leech Lake, and they ran their estimates of cormorant predation to try to determine if it's a factor, and it looked pretty minimal relative to everything else going on in the lake. So we didn't have the case, the smoking gun, to bring to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service refuge people to convince them that we need to control cormorants on Spirit Lake. The Mille Lacs Band works closely in trying to manage birds, and they are keeping accurate counts of that colony. Right now, that colony is about 500 nesting pairs, and I will draw your attention to Leech Lake. That colony, when it was at its peak, was 2,500 nesting pairs, mm-hmm. and the long-term management plan on Leech Lake is 500 nesting pairs, and it looks like walleye and perch now, or at least walleye anyways, on Leech are doing very well. So here we have one large lake that's a little smaller than Mille Lacs with a management plan for 500 nesting pairs, and then we have Mille Lacs that's already at 500 nesting pairs. We have a very difficult case to make with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that we need to go into Spirit Island and reduce the number of cormorants. So that's the situation that we're in right now. We don't think that colony is going to get much bigger because we think they've already used up all their nesting habitat. It's not much of a rock. So we don't think it'll be an issue, but again, with the Mille Lacs band, we're definitely watching it closely at least. If they show up in Hennepin Island, they're removed because Hennepin Island is being managed for terns, which is an endangered species. So the cormorants are not tolerated on Hennepin at all. Hopefully they won't build another colony someplace else in the lake and we won't have an issue. But it is one that we are watching closely. And I am glad that we actually got that public depredation order going on Pelican Lake as well, because that colony increased dramatically in the past couple of years. Mm-hmm. So that's a good thing that's happening there.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
Could I just add to that?
I don't know if you've spoken yet. Could you please state your name and who you represent for the record?
Sarah Stroman with the Department of Natural Resources. I would just add, if there's a theme to everything we're saying here, it's that we want to start managing what's ahead of us and not be managing in the rearview mirror. And so, as Mr. Pereira said, to make sure we're monitoring that closely, and I think that means some advanced work with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service so that when we get to the point where we think the cormorants may be an issue, we're not stuck in a delay pattern of having to start the process from square one, but that we're ready to act quickly to resolve that problem. So I think there's a general theme here of trying to, you know, be poised to be nimble and swift and reactive.
Senator Saxlock.
Well, thank you, Representative Hagbark. I don't even know if I raised my hand, but I'm happy. I can come up with a question, believe me. Yeah. No, and I kind of have some questions, too, as everybody here did. You know, we're all concerned about Mille Lacs and the huge fishing pressure and what's happened and how we're reacting to it and looking in the rearview mirror. And as Senator Rood did talk a little bit about Leech Lake, because it was cormorants, it was rusty crayfish. I'm trying to think of what the other problem was there that brought the population down. And did the population on Leech go down in spawning females like it did on Red, or it didn't ever get that far? And so what I'm saying, I just don't want to know about Leech here. We're talking about Mille Lacs. Are there any other factors in terms of invasive species or anything else that may be having an effect?
Chief Pereira.
So the first question on Leech Lake, spawners were actually quite high at the time that we started cormorant control on Leech Lake, and they never really dropped down that much. We didn't have to stock Leech Lake, but we did, appease local anxiety, if you will.
Yep.
We now know that from really good work on understanding walleye fry and actually being able to estimate abundance of walleye fry, that we have an optimal zone of fry density in Leech Lake that seems to be working really well. And in some years, we drove that density of walleye fry up so high that the feedback mechanisms resulted in a smaller year class. So we actually found out, and I would never have thought of this, and I've worked on walleye dynamics my entire career. I never would have thought we could have stocked too many little walleye fry in a lake. But the Leech Lake problem clearly shows that we did. But we now have a really good management plan for Leech Lake moving forward, where we will be able to use fry stocking, if needed, very precisely. And some of that information from Leech Lake we'll be able to hopefully use a Mille Lacs as well in the future, if needed. As Sarah Stroman said, we're going to have these advanced tools set up so we know when we have to act. Now, as far as the other, when you asked about other factors, were you asking about
invasive species or any other factors, no matter how minor that...
So on Mille Lacs?
Yeah.
So on Mille Lacs, the thing that's really scary is what these spiny water fleas are doing to zooplankton, because they're essentially competitors with the really tiny fish right after they hatch out. And a really tiny fish, the reason why it has a big head relative to its body is because it has to eat and it has to grow really fast. Because when you come out of the egg and you're a half an inch long, you've got an awful lot of predators in the lake. So if you have a competitor with larval fish, with tiny fish, that's cause for concern. But we're still seeing a lot of young year walleye. So apparently, but perch is like, we don't know what's going on with perch. There could be something happening there. In fact, our work up on Voyageurs National Park is showing a linkage between spiny water flea abundance and decreasing growth of small perch. And I think it's maybe Namekan or Rainy or whatever. So that's definitely of concern. That's work that we're doing in collaboration with national park biologists, and it's very troublesome.
Okay, members, we've got five more people that from the working group that would like to ask some questions. I'd like to wrap those questions up sometime within the next 8 minutes and then go to some discussion within the working group. So next is Senator Osmick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question on your methodology. You had a very long, many very long timelines. During those timelines, have you changed any methodologies? Have you changed any equipment? Have you gotten more sensitive equipment? Have you changed locations? I just want to get an idea on, mm-hmm. is a change in your graph as a result of better detection and better methodology, or is it because it's actually happening?
Very good question, and that's a question that fisheries biologists are constantly alerted to and aware of. For example, the big case study where the biologists failed to detect that was actually the collapse, the biggest fishery collapse ever in the world was the collapse of cod in the North Atlantic. It's because the DFO scientists did not realize they had a trend in catchability in their own trawl surveys. So fish biologists are acutely aware of that problem, and we're concerned about it in Mille Lacs as well. For example, our trawling is no longer working because of zebra mussels, so we're having to use something else instead. We know that seining really went down because fish were moving off into deeper water, so we don't seine anymore. So we're constantly thinking about that problem, and we're constantly carefully adapting our assessment program so we can better figure out what's going on. Some of our walleye gill net stations now are difficult to set because the milfoil is so thick and growing so deep now. So we know that some of our gill net stations' catchability is being affected because of the plants. We've made dramatic changes in the assessment program of Mille Lacs over the years. Initially, it was just 32 gill net sets for walleye in September all around the perimeter of the lake. Now it's 50 nets, and it's all over the lake, including the offshore mud flats and everywhere, so we have it covered. We have a forage assessment we're doing with fine mesh gill nets. Just look at abundance of minnows, yellow perch, Tulibee cisco. We do that in August. We have a dedicated northern pike gill net assessment that's specifically set in northern pike habitat, so we get a better assessment of northern pike as well. It's probably the most intensely assessed lake in North America right now for an inland lake. And when the Blue Ribbon panel looked at it, they were like very, very impressed. And those guys really deal with complex fisheries, and they would sniff out a problem with the trend. That's an excellent question, and it's a very good one, but it's one we're acutely aware of and we're always looking at.
One follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. One follow-up also. While we're all talking about investing in additional walleye, possibly additional walleye fry, would it not make a lot more sense also at the same time to be talking about the other fish, such as perch, such as other forage fish that we would invest at the same time to make sure that the walleye aren't eating themselves, that they're actually preying upon forage fish that would be maybe even a lot easier to maintain?
Trying to put more forage in the lake is just physically not possible at all. And that's why I wanted to draw your attention to that estimate of total predation that we made based on a walleye population that would be similar to Mille Lacs. 8,000 tons of forage consumed by the fish in 1 year to support that walleye population. We can't stock forage fish to make any difference at all. In fact, we did some calculations recently. If we really made an effort to put a lot of perch in the lake, a big effort to gather perch up someplace else and put as many as we can in the lake, we were going to feed that walleye population in the lake for like an hour. Like an hour. It's pretty daunting. What you see in the Great Lakes, where they've lost species like cisco, they take spawning fish from another population and put them in that lake and allow them to repopulate. We actually did that successfully right in Lake Elmo, right here east of St. Paul. We had records of a whitefish being in there many, many years ago. When we cleaned up the water quality problem, we brought spawning tulibee down from the Grand Rapids area, and we now have a vibrant tulibee cisco population in Lake Elmo that's providing great food for our tiger muskie fishery there. So that's the way you do that. You do it by introducing spawning adults. You can't put enough fish in to actually feed the predators in there. It's just not possible.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And going back a few years, 35 years or so, back in the 70s and 80s, one of the original invasive species to Minnesota, the common carp, was, I won't say problematic, I don't think we really knew that at that time. I was working with the Mille Lacs Band at that time on these fisheries issues, but they were netted for cat food and whatnot. Is the common carp not an issue anymore in Mille Lacs, or are they still being commercially netted?
Chief Pereira.
They're not an ecological issue. They're there. I mean, we have common carp in quite a few lakes. There's a number of lakes in the Alexandria area, for example, that have common carp, but those lakes don't, they're deeper. They don't provide the habitat where carp can really, really abundant. You typically see them in shallow parts of the lake. We had some concern about building a lot more harbors because that might create more carp habitat, but we don't think we have an ecological problem with carp in Mille Lacs. I'm not sure if there's still commercial harvest. I would have to check on that. I know that our bowfishers really like the bowfish farm in Mille Lacs because of the clear water and that's why we tried to leave it open at night this year so the archery guys could get out there and make use of some of those carp. But I really don't think common carp are an issue ecologically in the lake.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One other question. The zebras, mussels, are they, do we know, do you know, are they just a generalist as far as when they set up shop and attach to something? Are they, do they take any particular phytoplankton that's impacting the food chain that, you know, we know we need? Can you speak to that at all?
I know a little bit about that from talking to other biologists in other lakes that have been infested. They're filter feeders. They have a siphon, and they siphon small particles out of the water column. So they'll take everything from bacteria up to even the first instars of very small insects. If it's small enough, they'll filter it. So very small, like zooplankton that just hatched, could actually be filtered by a zebra mussel. Most of the algae in the lake could be filtered by zebra mussels. They don't like blue-green algae, and they'll coat them with a mucus and eject them, and that can actually kind of create a mess if you have it. We don't have a lot of blue-green algae in Mille Lacs, so that's not problematic. We are starting to see reports of large mats of filamentous algae, and that's something that's commonly associated with large colonies of zebra mussels, because all of their stuff kind of accumulates all around them and creates a really good environment for this filamentous algae to grow abundantly. Some areas of the Great Lakes, I believe Western Lake Huron, the whitefish netters can't set their nets in the bottom anymore because the quagga mussels and all this algae that they're mm-hmm. that they're driving, so they have to set their nets up off the bottom. So we're just hearing reports of starting to see that in some areas of the lake, maybe last year, or I know I heard about it this year as well.
Ms. McQuaid. Karen?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your presentation, Mr. Pereira. As I've mentioned already, and it's probably been in the press, I'm a biostatistician, and so I had a very nice opportunity to speak with one of your biologists and statisticians, and it was very, very helpful. And as I mentioned to Commissioner, I hope that we continue some of those discussions. It's led to a greater understanding that I can share with the folks back at Mille Lacs about what you do. Mm-hmm. And it's given me a great respect for the amounts of data and acknowledging just the fact that your scientists make their best efforts to do what they're doing. One of the things that I did as a result of the meeting that we held up at Mille Lacs with Commissioner Landwehr is conduct the first ever Mille Lacs area survey. So we have some data, finally have some data where we can look at why are we on such opposite ends of the spectrum on some of these things. And I shared some of that with Tom informally already, and we'll go formally later. One of the things that I noticed in the study is that our estimates of harvest rates, both in the first half of July and in the entire summer, are almost identical. Mm-hmm. So our estimates are saying about 2% and about 2.5 or 3, similar to what you are for the first half and the full summer. But where we differ, and some of that is perception because we don't have the full models, but where we differ has to do with the mortality rates and the estimation of fish in the lake. And I see room there because I think while any statistical methodology is only as good as the assumptions that go into that, and I think that there's some places where we have questions and perhaps could discuss that further. So I have two questions right now related to the mortality assessments. First of all, one that comes up commonly now, I seem to get a lot of phone calls, as does Ms. Chapman lately. One has to do with when you did the hooker mortality study, which is 12 years old, 11 or 12 years old, how far were those fish transported to those pens? Because, of course, that would increase the mortality rate. And the second question that I have is, why is only lake in Minnesota that is assessed mortality rates? There's other lakes that are netted. There's other lakes that have the co-management. The other ones have regulations. Why are we the only ones? Because when you talk about the tight margin of error on that 28,600 pounds, in the first half of July, we caught and kept 2,074 pounds, and these are numbers I wrote down from you. Mm-hmm. Five times that number were assessed to us in hooking mortality. Mm-hmm. And so the anglers really need to better understand that, and why is it only on our lake?
Well, first of all, it's not only on Mille Lacs. On all of our large lakes now, especially our border water lakes or lakes where we share the fishery like Red Lake, we do estimate hooking mortality, and we actually use the Mille Lacs model. We do it up on, well, we do it, I think, on all our large lakes now. But on Lake of the Woods and Rainy, those are co-managed with the province of Ontario. Okay. And then when we run our creels, we have to account for hooking mortality as well. So we run the models up there. What our biologist on Rainy Lake did a number of years ago, because there's a lot of walleyes that are caught deep on Rainy, I mean quite deep, deeper than 40 feet deep, he actually did a study to also estimate the impact of depth on hooking mortality as well. And so he basically developed a unique model for Rainy Lake that incorporates depth. So we take the hooking mortality problem pretty seriously in all of our large lakes. And it is a very difficult thing. I nobody likes seeing those fish wasted, and if we can find some other way to get around that, it would be great. I mean, we knew that fish being transported during the study was going to be stressful, and I'm pretty sure that we had quite a number of pens, and we were trying to fish pretty close to the pens to get those fish into the pens right away. That certainly was a consideration. I'd have to go back and look a little bit more closer at that. So,
I wonder if you included that in your model. Did you keep track of the length, the distance that they were transported to see if that played into that model?
We'd have to go back and ask the biologist that was the principal investigator on that study if they did that or not. So I know they recorded an awful lot of factors. So
yes.
Yeah.
I think I spent 4.5 hours with Mr. Jones, and
okay.
Just being able to pick up the phone and talk to him was greatly appreciated.
Yeah, Tom told me about your conversation. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to him. That's very useful.
Representative Hansen, are you on the phone? Representative Hansen?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you. Go ahead. Do you have a question?
Yes. In listening, it seems like we're doing a good job of measuring all the systems that are affecting the lake. We know a lot of numbers. We're tracking that. And maybe you discussed the overall issue of climate change. And there is succession in lakes. There is evolution in lakes. We've got a variety of invasives coming in here. Maybe backing up from looking at the details on each of the populations, and what is the outlook for the lake and the ecosystem there that feeds the lake. Maybe you mentioned that was the connection broke for a moment. Could that be addressed?
Chief Prayer, do you understand the question?
I think I did. He asked long-term implications from climate change.
Correct.
Well, if certain climate change forecasts prevail, I think the future for Tulabisisco is quite grim. Mille Lacs isn't a deep lake. Lakes where Tulabisisco will persist will be lakes with really good water quality that are deep. They can go down below the thermocline and reside in cold water with plenty of oxygen and still persist just fine. That's work that we did, intensive work we did actually statewide with engineers at the University of Minnesota that understand the thermal dynamics of our lakes and are able to do some of these forecasts. So, again, if certain forecasts prevail for the climate, then, 30, 40 years down the road, I really don't see how Tulabisisco can persist in Mille Lacs. They have no deep water cold refuge, basically.
Representative Hansen, did you hear that?
Yes, I did.
Okay. Anything further, Thanks. Representative Hansen?
Nope. I'll keep listening.
Representative Tomasoni.
Senator Thomas. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sorry.
I have the burning question. This was a great presentation and understanding what's going on in Mille Lacs and the crisis with the walleye. But that's only one of the reasons we're here. And the other reason we're here is because the resort owners, and not only the resort owners, but the spin-off effect that the lack of business at the resorts causes. Couldn't you extend this past Labor Day before you shut down the fishing? It seems to me there has to be a solution to not hurt the people that are on there, on the shores, making their money off of this and figuring out a way to do something. It seems to me if we took another 10,000 pounds out of the lake would still be there, and you guys would figure out how to bring it back, and the resort owners wouldn't be hurt. I am just absolutely shocked that this was shut down right in the middle of the summer without even considering the effect on these resort owners. And you got to tell me that that this is such a bad crisis that the lake will never come back if we would not fish for one more month, or even catch and release. I'm just shocked. commissioner. I really am. And I got 1,400 miners that are not working up on the Aran Range, and I know how bad it is, and so I know how bad it is for these people when they lose their jobs, and I heard there were three resorts today that had $25,000 in cancellations as a result of the announcement. And it just seems to me that there could have been something else done instead of just making this drastic decision. I'm open to any suggestions here.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, members, I can tell you this is the single worst action we've had to take in my 4.5 years, so this is not the sort of action we would like to have taken. But, you know, really there are two fundamental reasons we had to do this. One is just the long-term sustainability of the lake. You know, that some might argue that we should have gotten more restrictive earlier, and therefore maybe we wouldn't be in this situation. And, you know, we at some point we have to get restrictive, and if we go grossly over the sustainable harvest this year, we are just shooting ourselves in the foot next year. We're just digging the hole deeper. But just as importantly, as we have, you know, we have this agreement with the eight bands, and if we exceed our quota, we are in violation of that agreement, and that's a number of potential legal consequences to that. But we don't want to violate that agreement.
Well, it sounds to me like the bands are pretty understanding too, because they've announced they're not going to be netting next year, and they understand the importance of this. I'm the fact that we're sitting here thinking about a special session because the resort owners are being hurt as badly as they are, is something to me that I don't know how a decision of this magnitude gets made that we have to then go into a special session to save the people that we just hurt by shutting down the fishing. And I don't know, catch and release, something, I don't know. But it seems to me that Red Lake came back, Leech Lake came back. This is going to come back. It sounds to me like you can manage it, and it's going to come back. It's just a matter of when and how. And to be doing this at this time of the summer when it's fishing season is almost over, I guess we got to deal with it now, but I think it was questionable at best.
Sir, their estimates were 3,000 to 4,000 pounds will be caught between September 1st and November 30th. 3,000 pounds.
Okay, and I was just thinking of August, and I don't
not
know what I just took a guess. I don't know what the number is, but
not even 10,000, 3,000.
Yeah, I think I agree with Senator Tomasoni that I think something else could have been done along these lines. Commissioner, what's the plan? I mean, what is your plan at this point, barring any special session, or where's the department at in a fix for this situation? What are we looking at? What are you thinking? You guys have got to have been thinking about this and what route to take and which direction to go. What's the fix? What's your opinion on the fix? I know that Chief Pereira and I talked a few weeks ago about what's the problem with why aren't these fish growing up? What's killing those fish? And I guess we don't really know what's killing those small fish. We've got speculation. It's the overabundance of big walleyes. It's all these other predator fish. We didn't even talk about muskies. I don't know where the muskies are in this. I don't know why we didn't talk about that. But what's the fix? What would you moving forward to bring this lake back? The governor's talking about a special session. I don't know when he might do that. I don't know how fast this working group needs to work to address something that might be coming up at a special session. Like I said in the beginning of this, I was hoping that maybe this working group can do something without a special session, and I would like to see that. I want to talk to the revenue folks and MMB and see if there's some kind of packages that are already available that we can bring forward to help the resorts. Things like that. But from the department's perspective, you guys are at the table right now. What's the plan of action?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think you identified that there is sort of the biological question that lands with the department, and then there's the economic question. That's the other things that will be discussed later on to help the resort community and the launches and other folks get through this tough time. Biologically, and Don mentioned this, I think everybody's aware of this, we have some optimism with the 2013 year class. The lake itself really has to help us out here. You know, we don't, our only tool in managing the lake, and I kind of use that as a euphemism, we manage people. We don't manage the lake. We don't put anything in the lake, fish or nutrients or anything else. We manage the people.
I don't know if I'd keep using that line.
But we manage what people take out of the lake, and the state anglers, and so our tools are somewhat limited. But the 13-year class gives us great hope. We don't know yet what 14 is or what 15 is. If we even get average survival of those 14 and 15 age classes with what we've got in the pipeline in 13, Mr. Chairman, we're at the bottom and we're going up. And so we have to prepare for the potential that we are not at the bottom, and that is the discussion that we've had about the fish hatchery. But other than that, it is really, again, by regulation, regulating what we're taking out.
And is there anything we can do to help make that 2013 class survive? I mean, what do we know about that? Is there something we can do?
Mr. Chairman, and the two things that I'm aware of, and I'm not a fish biologist, I'm a wildlife biologist, so Don can probably correct me here, but one is, you know, as you saw in his one graph, northern pike can be a huge predator on young walleyes, and we have liberalized the pike season there, as you know, dramatically, especially the hammer handles, especially the smaller pike, to try and put the herd on them. We need more people to go up there and catch small northern pike is what we need. And the second possibility is, I think, to look at cormorants and see if we can't go to the Fish and Wildlife Service, present the case, you know, if they're not willing at this point to grant us a permit, make sure that we're ready, as Assistant Commissioner Strawman said, so that when the time comes we can jump on that. And I'm fully aware that when cormorants fill up a particular nesting location, they will very often go to another spot and set up another. So it's very possible that 400 to 600 nesting pairs could become 1,000 in a very short amount of time without
some control. Thank you for that, Commissioner. I really appreciate that. I believe that's the right way to go, too, that we should be pursuing that. Thank you very much. Members, Senator Sachs, on something very quick, we only have half an hour left. We have a lot to cover.
I'm with you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just wondering quickly, if we shut this down, or we have shut this down August 1st and it goes to November 1st, so we're talking about fishing during the winter season?
Commissioner Chief Pereira, what are we talking about when ice fishing comes? Are we going to open this up for walleye fishing?
It's too early to tell at this point. We need to do we have certain benchmarks that we want to achieve that we'll assess in our September gill nets. We want to see, you know, spawners over a certain number of pounds per acre. But we also need to see those 2013-year class fish persist as well, because if they suddenly have dropped in abundance, then that's going to be very grim news. Right now, it's looking really good, so we're really keeping our fingers crossed. We don't have all the information yet to state what's going to happen on December. The new fishing year starts on December 1, and we can't really speculate at this point what that's going to look like. But we'll know by the end of September and work with the tribes and try to figure it out.
Commissioner, Chief, as you know, and I think the resorters can attest, if we don't have walleye fishing in the winter, they're going to go broke. They're going to be out of business. So, okay, thank you very much for your presentation. You did a great job. Thank you very much for answering all our questions. Thank you. Members, I think now we have... I'm sorry. We need to discuss amongst ourselves which direction we need to go with this working group. You know, this is a relatively new situation for all of us, I think, about should we have a special session, shouldn't we? I'm hoping we don't have to. I hope that the governor will listen to the working group and see which direction we need to go. But it's really our call. So we need to listen to the resort owners. We need to listen to the governor's office and other folks that have weighed in, the DNR, and try to figure out which direction this working group is going to go. I mean, there's options such as let's listen to the Department of Revenue and MMB and the Department of Tourism, et cetera, about what can we do. I think that should be the next meeting to discuss some of these things. But I want to hear from all of you what you think we should do. I think we should maybe look at how much is it going to cost to put a fish hatchery and research center on Mille Lacs. Do we really need the research center to be part of that? There's a number of different ways we can go, and I'm looking for ideas. So at this point, I think, members, if you have ideas, let's hear them now. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Chairman. I have a couple of thoughts. One, I don't know, and I may be speaking out of turn, but I know a number, Senator Saxler, Senator Skoy, and the representatives, almost everybody other than Senator Marty and I are from a long distance away. I'm wondering, is it feasible for us to meet again, even, Mr. Chairman, as soon as tomorrow, and wondering if DNR can get back on a couple of things. One, it seems to me like we should pursue the cormorants to keep that flock down to where they don't start to establish another flock. And we've got some good data when we fix that on leech. And then I'd like to understand more about the stocking. Is there a way they can begin to plan that? And I didn't realize we had this option of Brainerd, so that's encouraging. And then, Mr. Chairman, I'm wondering about the discussion, and I really commend the Mille Lacs Band for what they did. That was really a huge step for them to say they're not going to seine and net next year. And I'm wondering if we would be able to use that opportunity, and is there a chance that the tribes from Wisconsin would follow the leadership of the Mille Lacs Band? It's their home reservation, and they're willing to do that. I would hope their comrades and their neighbors to the east would potentially follow. I say that because I think then DNR, that gives them more tools, and maybe some of this reaction where some of us have thought maybe they overreacted, are they taking into account that they potentially can raise fish in Brainerd, the cormorants, maybe we can control them. Have they taken into the account of the Mille Lacs Band not taking that? I think those are all good things, and Mr. Chair, I'd wonder if we potentially could meet relatively quickly.
Okay, thank you, Representative McNamara. That was going to be towards the end of the agenda, but we can talk about that now if members want to talk about possibly meeting tomorrow. And I think that some folks can meet tomorrow if that's possible for everyone. I can tell you that there's a number of people that cannot meet on Thursday and Friday. There's a lot of things happening. Farm Fest is happening. Game Fair is happening up in Ramsey. A number of different things are going on Thursday and Friday, and there's a lot of people that have other commitments. So Thursday and Friday is definitely out this week. I think that we could possibly meet tomorrow. I'm not sure what Senator Tomasoni thinks about that and your members, but we can discuss that now. Anyone else? Is it okay to meet tomorrow?
No chance.
I can too.
Brown, well, Brown may be able to. I can't personally, but I think what Brown said today is going to change.
Okay. Commissioners?
I think most of the commissioners can meet tomorrow. Okay. Tomorrow morning, I'm supervising the largest bond sale in the history of Minnesota in the morning, so I'll be busy doing that. But other than that, I'm available between 9 and noon, 9:30 and noon. But that's okay. I mean, I don't have that much to say anyway. You'll see.
The only one on this side is Dale. You can't make it?
Yeah,
you have a funeral? Yeah. Why don't we set a meeting for tomorrow morning at 10 a.m.? There'll be some members that can't make it, but that's just the way it's going to be.
So what time?
10 a.m.
Okay.
10 a.m. tomorrow morning, same place, same location.
2 hours.
Yep, 2 hours. Yep. We'll be done by noon. I would like if some of the commissioners can bring some suggestions to the table tomorrow on maybe some economic development packages or something that might already be available along those lines. Commissioner France, you had...
Mr. Chair, we actually could talk about some of that now if you want to take some more time. We have some... The governor really, in addition to asking Commissioner Landwehr and DNR to take a look at the biology and those issues,
right.
He's asked us to come up with some economic packages for us to consider, ways that would actually help alleviate the burden, as you mentioned before, of the local businesses, not just the businesses in the fish business and the resort business, but all those around. So we could go through some of that now if you'd prefer.
You have a presentation prepared? How long do you think it would take?
It won't take very long, I don't think.
Okay. Is that okay with members?
Yeah.
Somebody had their hand up over here. Did you have a question?
Mr. Chair, the only thing that I was going to recommend, and maybe they'll go through this, is that you look at what we did at the Red Lake Business Loan Program. Mm-hmm. I think it was pretty successful, but As far as a special
session. That's a good idea, Senator Skoy, but that was on such a much smaller scale that I think this is a bigger problem with a lot more businesses that are involved. So we can relate to that and talk about that and how that worked, and it did work well, but this is on a much grander scale.
The other point I was going to make is there's no way that you're going to know within a week or two what is going to be needed, because as we just heard, there's not information with regard to the winter fishing season, so you really can't anticipate until you know how that's going to go with regard to the economic plan. Understood. Because there's information that has to be gathered first.
But the time frame that we're presented with at this point, where there might be a possible special session, we have to come up with something now. So,
hopefully
that's not going
to
happen.
What I was subtly trying to say is that the special session might be a little premature.
Well, I agree with you 100%. Okay, please, let's hear your proposal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'd like to just start out. I had a chance to travel to Mille Lacs a couple weeks ago and meet with community members along with Commissioner Landwehr and the Department of Tourism. And from an economic perspective, we heard from resort owners that they are very, very concerned. It's basically an economic disaster situation where they're looking at how do they pay employees, how do they keep lights on, how do they pay their utility bills. And so there is a need for access to cash immediately to help them through the situation. And I know there are a few resort owners in the audience that could speak more specifically to it. The other piece is that, some of the stories, if walleye fishing was closed, they would have to lay off 18 of 27 employees. These are employees that live paycheck to paycheck. Does the state have a wage assistance program? In that situation, we would have an unemployment insurance program for those individuals, but nothing that would help keep them employed, which is what the resort owner was hoping to do. They also expressed the trickle-down effect of this reaching multiple businesses in the community, all the way down to the school district, and dwindling numbers of students, and this having a major impact on their economy. These are third or fourth generation resorts, in many cases, family-owned resorts, where the children are planning on taking on these businesses for their future careers. And so we do see this as a significant impact for this economy that's been built on being a nationally renowned walleye fishing lake. So I just wanted to share those insights from my travels there. As far as a financial assistance program, I think there are a few options for everyone to consider. We did look at the Red Lake legislation from 1999. I think what we would pull from that potentially is that we would recommend a standalone program specific to this Mille Lacs situation. I think the governor has expressed the potential of 0% interest loans available to businesses. And based on past history and how we've worked with areas impacted by natural disasters, there's a few examples that we could point to, but there could be situations where we offer those 0% interest loans, working with local lenders such as the Initiative Foundations, RDCs available locally. And we have done some initial conversations with them just to get a feel and a sense of what their timing or availability might be should there be a special session and should a package be passed. And they would be available to help get loans out, but it would take probably a month to get those resources out to the community as far as processing those applications and verifying what those business needs are. So I think depending upon how this working group pursues this situation, we stand ready to at deed to assist the community in whatever way a special session might bring forth. But a 0% interest loan potentially with a few years of deferral could be something to look into.
Commissioner Stephen, would it require a special session to develop that?
Mr. Chair, yes, it would require a special session to develop the standalone program specific to Mille Lacs.
Okay. Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Commissioner, are you sure you don't have the ability to set this up on your own without legislation? It seems to me at the IRRB we could do this. So I got to believe you could do this at DEEB also.
Mr. Chair, respectfully, I think the IRRB has different rules than DEED.
I can't imagine how.
We have done a full analysis of all existing programs at DEED. Really, the only program that is a match for this situation is our Indian Business Loan Program, but it would have to be a business-owned, Indian business-owned to be eligible for that program, but all of our other programs are specific to job creation numbers, may require a nonprofit lender to provide a 50% match, to give some examples. And so as we scrubbed the full list of programs at DEED, there is not an existing program. If we run into a natural disaster situation where we're offering aid, that requires a special session for the MIF Disaster Fund, which is a commonly used tool, but that requires federal declaration. So that would not be a fit in this situation.
Chairman, so is there anything in MMB or revenue that we can do without going into a special session that can help DEED give out the money?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman and members, I think the final part of your question was, is there anything that we could do at revenue to put money into a DEED-based program for economic development? And the answer to that, I'm afraid, is no. What we have done at revenue is look at other areas where we know that we have starting to hear from local governments about concerns on the property tax base. And so we did, as other agencies have done, is sort of scrub our statutes for any existing authority to help relieve any pressure on locals and perhaps local businesses. So I wanted to share with you some of our research on that. Under existing state statute, counties can abate property taxes. There are a couple of different provisions that allow for that. One is the disaster declaration, which is the most frequently used. Another is for economic development purposes, where a county may provide some property tax relief for job creation or other economic growth. And the final area, which is probably most relevant to this conversation, is is commonly referred to as the hardship exemption. And under that provision, counties can abate property taxes for any reason, and I'm just pulling out the statute, any reason the board deems just and reasonable. And so were counties in this effective jurisdiction to decide that they wanted to provide these hardship abatements to owners, to property owners, they could abate their property taxes. And of course, we know that local governments are providing essential services and that those property taxes do fund those essential services, and so they're going to have a budgetary challenge if they are taking that amount out of their budget. So what we would expect is that those, whether it was the county or the locals, would need to replenish that amount either from their reserves or by increasing their levy on the property owners in the following years. There is an option where this commission, where this group, to consider a special session where the state could consider providing general fund reimbursement to the counties who provided such abatement. We could provide a list of parameters, and one of the some of the issues we would ask you to consider and provide a direction on is, you know, which types of property would be eligible for reimbursement for those abatements. Is there a proximity to the lake, a connection to this industry? There would be questions that we would ask to provide some guidance on. But we know that counties already do have this authority, but again, they use it very sparingly because they face challenges both with their budgeting needs and also because you can imagine that they could make their people would come to them frequently with such requests. And so we wouldn't want to make sure that they are providing some direction and some guidance. So the three counties at issue here would have that authority. The other note I just did want to make, just because of the timing of it, as you're aware, state statute provides for county program aid and local government aid, and those certifications were certified as of August 1st, and those checks are going out this week. And so each of these counties will be receiving half of their share of their county program aid, for example. There is an existing statute, the capacity for the department to issue the second payment of that, which would come normally in December, as early as August 15th upon their request, if that county can show that they have a cash flow problem. And so there, if there were to be abatements and that would create a cash flow issue, we could certainly work with counties on receiving their second aid payment that would normally be paid in December early. This would not represent new funding to that local jurisdiction, but would be an advance of their program aid in December. So those are the parameters that we are, those are the areas of statute where there is existing authority and some considerations if this moves to a special session that you could consider for reimbursement to those counties who wanted to provide that property tax relief directly to their businesses. And I think the certainly the concern we've had is about the long-term maintenance of the property tax base. Were these businesses to go under, of course, that would take it off of their property tax rolls in the long term. We'd be happy to answer any questions.
Commissioner, Chairman Thomas Lane.
Commissioner Bowerly, so you mentioned the disaster declaration. Would that be? Would that come from the governor, the disaster declaration, or would the county determine that there was a disaster? And to follow up on that, depending upon who does, we have disaster aid money at the legislature. Can that be used for this particular purpose without us going back into special session?
Commissioner Bowerly. Commissioner Franz.
I'm going to turn to the determination, the person who's in charge of disasters.
We have two accounts that might be, that I think you're referencing, Mr. Chair. One of them that is the disaster contingency account. As you mentioned, we have put some more money. However, in that particular account, the disaster contingency fund may only be used to provide state match for federal disaster assistance or cost share assistance to local governments that sustains damage in a federally declared disaster but are not eligible for the federal disaster assistance. So we have to have a federal declaration. Now, we did expand that, as you know, this last session to include avian flu response activities. So the disaster contingency account can also be accessed for purposes of avian flu response activities. But that money will not be available until September 30th, but it'll be about $19.4 million in that account at that time. So we would need some other authorization to tap into that money for this particular situation. The other account that we have is the general contingency account that has $500,000 in that account. Now, the authorization for this allows transfers by MMB up to $5,000 or transfers between $5,000 to $10,000 with the governor's approval, or any amount above that can be made with the governor's consultation with the Legislative Advisory Committee. Those transfers must be made to an agency that has the appropriated authority to then issue that money to a particular purpose that would be consistent with their appropriation authority.
And Mr. Chairman, so you're like thinking of giving it to a county that could then give the money to the resort owners, or what?
This would have
or
to go
an through agency.
State agency. Mr. Chair, it'd have to go through a state agency.
Aren't you an agency?
What's that?
Aren't you an agency?
Well, it'd have to go from this from the MMB to another agency.
Okay, you could give it the deed, I see.
Yeah, right. That's possible. I think actually also Director Erdman has some information about the tourism that might be of assistance too.
Mr. Chair, I have a question specific to comment on abatements.
Representative Lloyd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First comment. Suggesting that three counties run tax abatement programs for 20, 30, 40, 50 businesses. I did that in another life, TIF districts and counties. I frankly don't think we want to go there. That's a huge, huge administrative burden to try to put on counties, and then the local taxpayers in the rest of the county are going to foot the bill for it. What I would suggest and we take a look at and an abatement program that's specifically applied to the businesses, not the seasonal rec property owners, that went back and looked at the 2014 state business property taxes that those businesses paid. It would involve about 15 townships and cities that surround the lake. And figure out where we can get the money to do that, and simply consider going back and abating directly those particular taxes. I would just urge caution here to try to run down the road that to force these counties into trying to solve a problem that they really had nothing to do with. I realize that that's an option. I don't see any of them here right now. But stop and think about the scope of that. That means a tax abatement for each one of those businesses. In other words, the parcels. I understand how this works. But to do this from a state perspective, and I just suggest, go back and look at what these businesses, about 15 townships, including the cities, paid in state business property taxes in 2014, and consider writing a check right now back to those folks. But do that from a state perspective. And I know that likely would take special legislation. But, boy, please, let's not make it worse and more burdensome for the counties. Thank you.
Mr. Bowerly, can you look at those figures and maybe come back with some of that information?
Sure, Mr. Okay. Chairman and Representative, certainly we wanted to identify what was available in existing law and delineate what session would need to be called for, and we're happy to take a closer look at what that might look like.
Please take a look at that and see if you can come with that information, maybe even tomorrow if that's possible, if you can get it that quickly. I don't know.
We'll take a look at it.
Okay. And before I go to Senator Skoy, I would like to ask Commissioner Sieben, how much money are we going? Are we talking about? Do we have a dollar figure yet about how much that might be if we go to special session and ask for X amount of dollars to handle what you were explaining?
Mr. Chair, so one of the points of clarification we would need to come up with that number is what's the geographic boundary of the area that would be considered for this financial assistance package. We have taken an estimate at deed from roughly the center of Lake Mille Lacs, creating a 15-mile radius. There's 112 tourism and hospitality-related businesses within that that 15-mile radius. So if we, as one example, offered 0% interest loans up to $100,000, could roughly be a $10 million package. That is very, very rough estimates and shouldn't be, what we stand on, but just to give you a sense of what we've been able to uncover thus far.
Okay, very good. Senator Skoy.
On the tax issue, many times the state will provide an aid to help the locals with the cost of the abatement. And with regard to the value of the properties that had conversations with the local assessor as of 2 years ago, the values were down $31 million, which is almost 5%. That's 2 years ago. He said there was excess land on the market now driving the value down. The expectation is for that to continue downward at a faster rate than they had prior to this. So there is a real valuation issue developing around there. And if I could say, on the loan, for the 0% interest loan, my thoughts is these businesses don't need more debt. So whatever's going to happen here needs to be forgivable.
Mr. Edmund.
Sure. Thank you. Thank
I'm
you.
Sorry, we got off on a different tangent there.
No,
I'm sorry.
That's all right. I'd be happy to pivot towards tourism. From Explore Minnesota, our mission is to promote increase the number of travelers to and within the state of Minnesota. And Mille Lacs is a premier destination we've been working with for years, and travelers come from all over the state and all over the region, not just for fishing but all the other recreational opportunities. But recognizing some of the challenges that has been facing the fishery that hasn't just started this year, it started actually years before, we've been working with the businesses and the communities in Mille Lacs for many years to try to promote the diversity of attractions that are found there. About 3 years ago, we provided them a $35,000 crisis grant, which was basically recognizing that things were changing, that they needed to diversify, that they needed to come up with a new brand. And that really was kind of to give them the foundation. The legislature then, about 2 years ago, approved an appropriation of about $100,000 to help then take that new brand, that messaging, and out to consumers. Then the last legislative session, the one that just ended, there was a $30,000 appropriation that was given to Mille Lacs, which basically, I just signed that that partnership agreement, which really I think will now help them just over the short term, over this particular crisis period, but we have a lot of negative PR issues to overcome. So when we were asked the questions of what is needed to help this situation from a tourism marketing perspective, we took a look at what has been done to develop the brand, how they're diversifying, and we really think that there needs to be a program to carry this farther to consumers. So we're actually suggesting a program that wouldn't just be a 1 year and a done, it'd be a 2 year program, which about, I mean, it's a very rough figure, is about $400,000, that it would involve a package of about $100,000 per year for consumer marketing, about $50,000 for PR, because I think it's really important to get those positive messages about all the different things, all the different species of fish, all the different recreational opportunities that are attached. And then we've also talked to the community about a desire to promote events funding, to bring new existing as well as new events to the area that can help the businesses. This isn't going to be something that's going to be a band-aid, it's going to all of a sudden solve it overnight, but it's something that has to be addressed over the long term. I think they're on the right track right now and trying to diversify, but they need the assistance, particularly in light of all of the attention that is being brought to the situation, and so we really want to help them.
Okay. Commissioner France?
Mr. Chair, I just want to thank you, first of all, for including us in this working group. I think one of the key things that the Governor Dayton, through the commissioners, has made clear is that we've got some ideas of how to proceed. We need your feedback. We need your suggestions, how to fine-tune this. But clearly, from our point of view, from the governor's point of view, it's going to take some money, and it's going to take some statutory authority. You know, we respect the authority that the legislature gives us, and the legislature doesn't give us a lot of authority to spend money without direct appropriations, unless there are specific disasters or unusual.
If the DNR a lot of authority to spend money without.
Well, that's another whole world. But anyway, so we respect your authority, and I think that, you know, that's why we wanted to come to you with this package of opportunities to move forward if you deem it appropriate. So we're glad that we're here. We're happy to provide any information we can so that all the working group can feel like they can contribute to and decide the basis of whether to go forward or not.
Okay.
So, Mr.
Senator Tomasoni?
So what are we going to do tomorrow?
Well, I would hope that the commissioners would bring more specific information about their proposals.
I think that's a good idea. Chair,
I'm sorry?
Mr. Chair, right here. And could they also bring to us any unexpended dollars that we have given them recently that like DEED may have some that dollars that they could repurpose? We'd like to know that.
Okay.
So we know whether or not there's money lying around that hasn't been expended that perhaps we could repurpose.
That's a good point as well. So I think let's everybody, including the commissioners and the different departments, bring your ideas tomorrow, more specific information about what directions we can go. I think that's some of the things we have to do. Ms. Coyne?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One just point of information for all of you. One of the things that DNR didn't point out, they're very optimistic about this 2013 year class. But it is going to take until 2018 to impact the fishery and our ability to conduct business. Yep. So please think long term. And thank you for thinking about our area.
Mr. Chairman, do we want more input from the resort community tomorrow?
Absolutely.
I mean, is there...
Can we go?
There's folks in the audience as well. We have two people that wanted to speak. I don't know if they can come back tomorrow or if... if you can make it very, very quick, we can take you now. Okay. Byrne Wagner? We were going to allow 2 minutes for each member of the audience to speak.
Byrne Wagner, avid bass fisherman, frequent flyer down here, and a Santa. 142 days till Christmas. Sounds like you're asking all the right questions. As an angler, I'm saying you're asking all the right questions. I think you need to pursue what Commissioner Landwehr brought up about the pike, because not knowing about perch, which are a big part of the where the walleyes feed, not knowing about perch is kind of unacceptable. We should know more about what's going on in the perch population in Mille Lacs. And we also know that small northern pike are really hammering the perch in that lake. So we have to do something to get smaller pike caught. Opening Mille Lacs up to spear giant pike doesn't address the small pike issue. The second question is, the culture up on Mille Lacs, I have a cabin up there, is the anglers and the launches on the lake do not like creel survey workers. They don't participate in creel surveys. They don't tell the DNR what they're really catching. This has been going on for a long time, and we believe that if you're commercially operating on Mille Lacs, taking people out for hire, then you should be required to report your catch. And that's something that could add to the measurements that we need. Because if the DNR is not getting accurate information from the anglers, because anglers know that if I come in and say, I caught 10 walleyes, the DNR are going to say, delayed mortality, delayed mortality, delayed mortality, and they're going to reduce the slot even more. So they're not going to tell. The third issue is, today, the DNR just did a great thing. They announced that you could do what's called culling in bass tournaments on Mille Lacs, something I've been working for months. What this means is that now we can bring bass tournaments to Mille Lacs. They can catch a fish, and if they catch a larger fish, they can release the one they caught and put a bigger one in, and then they bring them all in, and they weigh them. See, Mille Lacs was a catch-and-release fishery for many years, and during that time, Mille Lacs became a trophy smallmouth destination. It has a national reputation for being trophy smallmouth. However, this is not being marketed. The walleye ethic is being marketed, not the trophy bass. We still have one more obstacle, and that is on Mille Lacs, you can only bring in one smallmouth over the length of 18 inches. Our national tournaments, I mean, we're talking tournaments with $2-4 million of economic impact, probably are not going to come if they can only bring in one fish over 18 inches. That does not showcase that lake. So if you're bringing these fish in and then you're letting them go right after the tournament, we believe that you should be able to bring in five big fish and let them go because you're not harvesting them. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Vern.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Tomasoni. Vern.
No, so now we know for sure Santa is real.
And remember the naughty and nice part.
All right.
Ms. Chapman. Ms. Chapman.
One of the things the DNR has done is expand that northern regulation and are inviting people to come and harvest them. Something that we've suggested to them is if you want those out, maybe the DNR should work to take them out as well, if they want them out quickly rather than relying on the anglers. Now, here's the tourism director saying that. But that is something that we have brought to their attention, and it didn't get addressed. Another thing I'd like to address is we have been marketing smallmouth intently with the dollars that we have. So we have been doing that.
That's a good point about the little hammer handle northerns. I think we should be doing something with that as well, particularly with the DNR. Thank you, Vern. Bill Eno?
Bacon.
Welcome to the committee, and please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Bill Eno, Twin Pines Resort. Mr. Chairman, I've got just 2 minutes here, so I'm just...
Well, you got three. Vern took three.
Okay, bullet points here. I hear the term always about the resorts. And, you know, it's not about just the resort. It's the Mille Lacs community. I think that's a better description of what's happening up there because we've all been, you know, there's been over 50 businesses have dropped in the last 10 years up there. So we've lost a lot of our community, and our community has been under a dark cloud for a long time. Now, some other points here. Oh, and then I would kind of disagree a little bit about the launches. We provide our information, and I mean, I'm in touch with a lot of the launch drivers, so I don't think we're as villainous as we might be perceived. But I think stocking is a very important thing to consider, and I think that we really need to review the genetics I think that that's, I have some experts that I'd like to get into a discussion with somebody with about it. You know, diversity, genetic diversity is good. If you look around this room, genetic diversity is all around us. It's in agriculture, it's in everything. I think that's something to take a look at. I believe we should start commercially removing the northern pikes. That is the least, the most desirable fish on the lake and probably one of the biggest predators. And if you're going to take some action, let's start making some things happen. Presently it's not happening. I think this whole system has been flawed, and we need to go back to day one when the co-management was ordered. The lake seems to be in a downward trend since that time period. Who has the authority? Who do they report to? You know, the two groups have been meeting over the years in secret. I think that, you know, that there's a reason that there's freedom of information. I think everybody needs to know what we're talking about, what are the hidden agendas, what's really going on out there. It's something to really consider. I think that we should discontinue commercial harvest of bait fish. That would be shiners, any type of forage that's in the lake, because every time a shiner is eaten and not sold, that's one less perch and one less walleye that's eaten. So I think that's necessary. And then just for ice fishing, I just want to, you know, it doesn't like opening a Hallmark card store. Like, I need to know now, and I'm going to start spending money. I have been already. I'll be spending money, and I mean in wages. It takes me September, October, November, December to get ready. Materials, labor, fixing trucks, this. I mean, there's a lot. So I could probably put $40,000. And if you're going to just shut me down, well, and I take out, you know, that's a loan that now I'm not going to repay. And so if I find out, and that's one of the bad things about this process is we don't find anything out until 2 weeks. Customers call, you know, cancel. That's where that all happens. There's no information that hasn't been known that they couldn't make some of these decisions in enough advance time. It's finding out that there's no night fishing after we've got launches booked. Finding that out 2 or 3 weeks before opening, that's crazy. It just throws the whole area into a tizzy. So I think that's all my bullets I had. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Okay, members, please bring your ideas, more defined information tomorrow so we can start working on putting something together. With that, we'll see you tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. Meeting adjourned.